You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here tonight, and thanks to Jess for joining me. Before we kick things off with our discussion tonight about women in venture capital and tech, I see we have a lot of women in the audience tonight here. And so just to get a sense of the room, could you maybe raise your hand if you work in the tech industry? Okay, so I see a lot of hands. And so Jess was CEO of Polyvore for a long time. Could you raise your hand if you're considering starting a company and running it? Okay, still some hands there.
Good, we need more.
Well, great. Well, so maybe just to kick things off, Jess, I know you've had a really interesting career here so far in San Francisco, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that path that you took. So could you tell us a little bit about your road to becoming CEO of Polyvore?
Sure. So I don't think I started with a dream of being CEO of a tech company. When I was growing up, I grew up in Hong Kong. I wanted to be a graphic novelist. I really love comics. I'm going to Comic-Con this week. And that was my plan. I was going to draw comic books. But my parents are Asian. So they said, no, you can't go to art school. You should go study, be a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. None of which I did. No, doctor, lawyer, or judge. Those were the three. But I ended up coming to the U.S. I went to Stanford University, studied computer science, and then ended up as a product manager at Google. So that was my first experience in tech. It was an amazing time, a great place to be, to sort of learn what great tech cultures look like, and to get a chance to work on products that really impacted a lot of people. Then one day someone showed me Polyvore. So Polyvore is this fashion platform where it lets people mix and match their favorite products and create outfits, and millions of people shop those outfits. And I started as a really passionate user of Polyvore. So I fell in love with the product. I started using it every night for hours. And then I got annoyed with little things because I was a product manager. And so I started to keep a list of problems, and I wrote in to the founders to say, hey, I have some suggestions and complaints. And they wrote back and they said, these are all great. Why don't you just come work here and fix it all yourself? So that is literally how I ended up with a job at Polyvore. I was one of the first hires. I was the first product manager. And from there, I think inside of a startup, one of the best things is there's way more to do than there are people. So you just have this opportunity and a lot of autonomy to volunteer and pick up different things. So I just kept volunteering, whether that was washing the dishes or selling the ads or finding the office or writing code. I just kept picking up responsibilities because no one was stopping me. And then along the way, the founders came to me one day, probably a couple of years in, and they said, hey, we've always thought of you as a founder. You've always acted like a founder. So we'd like to just start calling you a founder. We're going to make you an honorary co-founder, and we're actually going to give you some of our shares. So they actually gifted me some of their ownership in the company, which is an incredibly generous thing to do, which I think just speaks volumes to the culture and the sort of character of the three original founders. So that's kind of how I ended up a founder of Polyvore. And then a few years after that, I kept volunteering, and so most of the new departments were reporting into me, even though my title was VP of product. But everything else reported into me except engineering. And at that point, the CEO said, hey, maybe you should be CEO, and then I stepped into the CEO role. So that is how I ended up CEO. I mean, it was definitely not a planned thing. It wasn't a company I started. I thought, let me just go to a startup and learn as much as I possibly can. And that turned into me running the company. So I think anything is possible in tech, but it is a pretty unusual path.
Got it. And so, you know, can you talk to me a little bit about that decision to leave Google for a much smaller company that a lot of people maybe weren't familiar with?
Yeah. So let's see. When the opportunity came to me and they said, hey, why don't you just join? I could hear my parents, my Asian parents, in the background saying, why would you ever leave Google? That's a great job. But I really thought to myself, how rare is it to find a product you're really in love with and an opportunity to shape it from the very early days, right? And so I thought about it a lot. I weighed the different decisions. It definitely wasn't an easy decision, but I realized that one of the best things you can do for your career is to maximize for learning and growth, which was some of the advice that I got in the beginning of my career, and is actually why I ended up at Google in the first place, was Marissa Mayer, who was at Google at the time and later became the CEO of Yahoo. She told me in my very first interview at Google, she said, when you have two decisions, two paths, try to pick the more challenging one, because even if it's, as long as it's hard, at least you'll grow and learn and maybe you'll succeed. So optimize for the learning. So I just kept thinking about that advice and realized, if I go to this tiny company that might go out of business tomorrow, at least I'll learn and grow. And then after I made that very difficult decision, I remember I walked into the office of the VP of product at Google, and he said, you can always come back. And then I realized there are, you know, lots of opportunities where there are ones that come and go that are fleeting, that are once in a lifetime, and there are ones that sort of are steady and available to you. And you should, if you want to be 80 and look back and not regret any of those things, you have to go for the one that's a little bit more risky and the one that's fleeting. So that ended up making me feel a lot better, and it totally turned out to be a great turning point in my career.
And so you just mentioned how you worked with Marissa Mayer during your time at Google. Also wanted to ask, you know, eventually you did sell Polyvore to Yahoo. So can you talk to us a little bit about that decision and what that process
sure.
was like?
Oh, so Polyvore was a total roller coaster of ups and downs. We built a pretty incredible user base, a community of women all around the world who loved expressing their style. And, you know, part of what we were trying to do was democratize fashion. And instead of editors at Vogue saying, this is what you should look like and this is what you should wear, our approach was, let's let the community decide what's cool, and everyone should, you know, be themselves and dress the way they want and feel great about it. And if you feel good about how you look, maybe you'll feel more confident in general, and you know, you'll be better. So that was always the thesis. But we built out this great community. We built out a shopping engine that helped people buy things, and we built a business, and we had a great technical team. But as the winds of desktop and mobile were shifting, I think I realized that we weren't on a path to the IPO or that sort of magical Silicon Valley outcome that people shoot for. So I realized it was time to sell the company. And so that became a mergers and acquisitions process. So talking to a lot of the partners we had worked with over the years, and it just so happened that Yahoo was looking to invest in lifestyle. So those conversations ended up working out. Yeah.
Got it.
But it was a very difficult, very hairy decision, very long, arduous process. Selling a company is not a wonderful, like, I think TechCrunch, or it gets glorified in tech, what that feels like and what the process is like, and those outcomes are celebrated, but it's very arduous underneath. And in general, I would say founder life is a little bit glamorized, and it's actually really hard. Yeah.
And so can you talk to me a little bit about your decision to leave the company and then move into VC? When did that happen?
Sure. So I had gotten to know Sequoia Capital, which is where I work now, over the years. Some of the partners, I think we met at a conference, and I shared a cab ride home with, to the airport with one of the partners. So we just kind of got to know each other, and then we kind of kept in touch over the years. And after Polyvore was acquired, I'd been there for a while. I just started to think, like, what do I want to do next? And two things occurred to me. One, I was like, well, how do I take all the lessons I learned as a founder? What can I do with that? I could do it again, but the problem is the type of company I love, or the type of company I want to start, is in the wacky social entertainment consumer end of the spectrum of companies. And that's the hardest space. So if my odds before as a first-time founder were 0.1%, as a second-time founder, maybe they would double to 0.2%. And I was like, is that what I want to do? Am I excited enough about any of these ideas to want to do it for another 10 years? And I decided, I don't know. And at that point, Sequoia had been reaching out, and I thought the other way to make something useful out of what I've learned is to help the next generation of founders. And I also thought about, is there a way for me to change the ratio? Because I was a female founder, pitching a product targeted at women, you know, 9%, 91% of venture capitalists are men. And so to go into a room full of men and tell them, imagine this amazing app where you could shop all day long. It's amazing. A lot of them were like, wow, that sounds like my worst nightmare. So you could never rely on that innate empathy to sell the company or to pitch the company. So instead, we had to come up with other tricks. But I just remember that struggle. And I thought, okay, maybe if I go to the other side of the table, maybe I can make a little bit of a difference. Maybe I can find great female founders in spaces that are actually massive markets that cater to women. Maybe I can work on some of that and learn something new. I'm optimized for learning, going back to that lesson, and do something useful with all the things and all the painful lessons I took away from my founder journey.
And you mentioned some tricks that you kind of developed to raise funding in that tough environment. Can you maybe share with us what some of those were?
Yeah. So, you know, I think it can be a mistake sometimes to rely on empathy to make someone else understand what your company does. Right? You know your user better than anyone as the founder, but someone who's an investor or someone new or even a new employee, they maybe don't have that intuition. So coming up with the right analogies ended up being the right trick, or coming up with sort of illustrative examples. So what I ended up doing is I took a stack of Vogue magazines, September issues, the really thick, like 1,000-page ones, and I would take them and I would throw them on the table at the and I would just say, this is hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue for this 1 month issue of Vogue magazine, the September issue. Imagine that on the internet. And they're like, oh, I get it. I don't have to understand why people read these things because I'm not interested in them, but I understand the value. I see them all over the place and I can imagine the analogy of that on the internet. So that's what ended up working.
And so you were the first female investing partner in the US for Sequoia. So what was it like to come into that role?
So I was the first partner, but we had other women inside of the firm as well as other women investors. And we had lots of women in the China and India office who were investors. So I think I came in and already, you know, they say there's a difference when there's two women in the room. So I felt very supported right from the get-go. And honestly, I wouldn't have gone there if I didn't already feel like it was a diverse and inclusive, an environment that was inclusive and would allow me to be myself. And one of the things I looked for when I joined Sequoia was, can I be myself? Can I find my own authentic style as an investor? And I looked around the table and I saw everyone was very different. Like we have the former CFO of PayPal, who's, you know, very financially minded. We had the CEO of Zappos, who knows how to run, like is very operational. We just had lots of different types. We had a two-time enterprise founder, the founder of AdMob. Everyone was very operational, but different. So I felt like, okay, they're clearly all very different. At least there is an acceptance of diverse intellectual styles. And then I heard about other programs inside of Sequoia. Like there was already, before I got there, a program targeted at mentoring women at the portfolio company. So I was like, okay, this seems like a place where I can be myself and where I can learn from some of the best. Because Sequoia has been around for 45 years. It's remained one of the top venture firms throughout that time, which is actually pretty incredible. And it's not because it's the same person running the firm. It's not Don Valentine, the founder of Sequoia, is not active anymore. So somehow they've captured this sort of magic and tribal wisdom, and they've passed it down from generation to generation. And I can see that now that I'm there. I can see all the investment in a culture of apprenticeship and training. And that's what made me comfortable about going to Sequoia.
About a year before you joined, Michael Moritz, one of the most prominent partners at the firm, made some comments in a TV interview about how they wouldn't lower the bar to hire a woman. Mm-hmm. How did you weigh those comments when you were making your decision to join?
So they were talking to me before he even made those comments. So mm-hmm. I remember thinking at the time, I wish someone knew that they were talking to me because they wouldn't. Yeah. Anyway. So that's kind of how I felt, yeah. But I mean, that relationship pre-existed by like multiple years, right? So, yeah.
Got it. And so what has the biggest difference been between your life as a founder, CEO, and now as a venture capitalist? Mm.
So as a founder, you have this sort of daily checklist or regular set of goals you're working towards. You feel this constant sense of accomplishment. Even if things are not going well, at least you know you're working and you're making progress in some direction. The weird thing about venture capital is, you know, it's very serendipitous. Like, you can't necessarily control who you meet or when you come across what you think will be the next great company. So it's very an undefined kind of job. And there's many, many different ways to meet companies, right? Like, you could be a networker and a hustler who goes to every event and meets all the founders. Like, that's not my style. You could come up with something programmatic. You can, you know, call on the right, all different types. So it's very unstructured. And you're not checking things off a list. And the other part of it is you don't have any idea if you're good for 8 years. So, you know, I could make a bunch of investments now and have literally no idea if those companies are going to, you know, be amazing or shut down for a very long time. So that's one unusual part of being a venture capitalist.
And so the firm has such a strong reputation, and there's a lot of partners who have been there for a long time. How have you found your role as a new partner within a firm like that?
Mm. So the first few months was a lot of training. So I would say some firms, everything is a very individual sport, and you're sort of this collective of like people who occasionally meet, you know, every Monday to talk about things. And some are very, very team oriented. And so I would say we're way on the team oriented side of the spectrum. And so in the beginning, I just went to lots of meetings with the other partners, right? They would invite me to their founder meetings. And the most important part of that was debriefing after a founder meeting to sort of see how did you think through that investment? What did you think of that pitch and the learning that came from that? In particular, you know, there's three things venture capitalists often look at: the product, the market, and the team. And team, like, you, over time, you develop an ability to evaluate a team, right? Because you hire people, you work with people. That's something everyone gets to kind of know. If you understand the problem that the company's trying to solve, then you can kind of evaluate the solution, which is the product, right? The hard part is to actually understand markets, because you might be hearing about a market for a first time. Like, you know, I took a meeting with a founder who was working on fish farming. That is not something I know anything about. So it's not until you see multiple companies in one space or another partner sort of gives you that shortcut. Here's everything you need to know about this space. Here's usually what happens. And that learning is so important. So that tribal knowledge is, you know, I think Sequoia does a really good job of trying to push that out and make sure it's shared, not like hoarded. So that was, you know, the first few months was just taking every possible meeting, trying to learn as much as possible, debriefing with everyone else. Then I moved into the sort of a phase of, okay, now I've seen a lot of different areas. Where do I want to focus? So then I started to specialize a little bit more. I love, like I said, the wacky social consumer end of things. I spent a lot of time there. A big interest in mobility, autonomous vehicles. So that was one category. I have a lot of interest in the female consumer. So looking at companies that target moms, young millennial women. It's a space I understand. And then commerce, making direct-to-consumer brands, although that's a very difficult business. But so those are some of the areas that I've started to spend more time in.
And so I know, you just started making investments. Can you tell us a little bit about the ones that are public right now?
Sure. So one theme that I forgot to mention is the future of work. I think what's interesting is, although unemployment is at an all-time low, it's pretty clear that some of the country has been left behind from an employment perspective. So it's been interesting for me in particular to look at companies that try to solve the not just white-collar employment but blue-collar underemployment issues. So two companies that I work with are Wonolo and Crew. So Wonolo is an on-demand staffing platform. It matches blue-collar workers to shifts and helps them. You know, if you're underemployed, you're working 29 hours at your main job and you want more shifts, you want more hours, and you want a diverse set of things, different types of jobs. Maybe you could be delivery driver one day. Maybe you could be you could pack meals at the airport. And what I loved about this team was that the founders, they actually do those jobs themselves. They really think about it from a mission-oriented perspective. They want to make sure that they solve the underemployment, they never lose sight and lose touch with the community of workers. So the fact that they actually go and do those jobs themselves on the weekends, like, I love that about it. And I love that it was a technology solution solving for this massive inefficiency and actually helping improve people's lives. So that's one company. The other is Crew, which is sort of a messaging app for frontline workers. So if you're, let's say you work at Taco Bell or at a Target, it's a tool that you can use to communicate with your coworkers and sort of get messages and headquarters and coordinate, because there's actually a lot of coordination that has to happen, but there's no tools internally. So that's one area, and those are two of the companies that I work with.
And you mentioned your kind of interest after doing Polyvor and the out there wacky social apps.
Yeah.
It seems like a really difficult space to invest in, especially with some of the struggles that we're seeing the larger social companies like Facebook and Twitter have right now. Mm-hmm. So what do you look for when you're evaluating companies in that space?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like a hits driven business almost. And you have to have a founder who... I look for two things. One, you kind of have to have a sense of what cool is, right? Because a lot of consumer social products, they just have this moment where they're really hot and cool. And some people just know how to do that. They know how to create culture. They know like what motivates people to want to try something, whether it's, you know, the vanity or the likes on Instagram, like they just know. So that's part of it. But that's not enough, because the problem is as soon as you get too big or too mainstream, you're not cool anymore. That's like the obvious, like it's just the cycle. So when you work in that part of tower, you know, build products in that space, you have to understand that you're on this treadmill of cool, and you have to constantly keep coming up with the next thing. And you have to be able to be like, you have to be okay with that. And that takes a certain psychology to like know that the thing you're building, you're just going to have to build something else again. And you have to be able to move really quickly, because it's not necessarily that you're this artist who divines like what's cool. It's also because you just try stuff. And so those are some of the ingredients I think that are really important for founders who work on that kind of product.
And so what are some cool apps you've seen lately?
I lost my phone today, so I can't pull it out. Okay, this is the worst. I have so much separation anxiety. Man, I really wish I could just pull out my phone. What have I been using lately? Honestly, the Comic-Con app, because I was trying to plan what to do. Reddit is probably the app that I use the most. It's got great community. There's some wacky niches of communities in there, but that's probably the social app that I use the most, probably after Instagram. Yeah.
Got it. And you mentioned mobility too. And, I think a lot of us in this room were probably tripping over scooters a couple months ago here on the sidewalks. And so I know Sequoia just was, they just led that very large round in the scooter company Bird. How are you thinking about what's going on with scooters right now?
Yeah. So I don't think we've seen so much consumer demand for something. I know there was a lot of hatred of the scooters, but at the same time, there was a massive demand to use them. Because when something is that easy to pull up and just use and go, it kind of changes the way you think about traveling within a city, right? Like before, I would never walk like a mile to the restaurant nearby. But after with an easy form of mobility, like a scooter, that actually becomes like not a bad trip. So people change a little bit of their behavior. And that's, I think, why we saw so much demand for the scooters. And then the same thing happened with Uber, right? The taxi industry was not huge before, right? But once the cost structure changed and once Uber was introduced, now people started to do more of those trips. The other thing is now the streets are incredibly congested with cars, many of which are probably Ubers driving around looking for passengers. So I think we would actually end up with far less congestion and traffic if those very short trips move to scooters instead. So anyway, I think it will happen. I think there's got to be a lot of changes to make it safe and not all over the sidewalk, and public infrastructure and roads will have to change. But I think there's a big shift happening in mobility and the way cities are formed, right? The way traffic flows, the way we live into cities, urban migration is happening. Like everyone is moving more and more into cities, and housing prices are going up, right? And that's just not sustainable. So there's a lot of things going on across the fabric of a city, and there's lots of interesting companies being formed. Yeah.
And you mentioned your familiarity with products for women. And so I just wanted to ask you, you know, as one of the only female partners in the U.S. at Sequoia, I mean, do you feel pressure to champion companies that are either for women or founded by women? Mm.
So that's the other thing that I love about Sequoia is when I got there, there was already a bunch of investments in women's spaces. So we were the investors in Stella and Dot, which sells jewelry to women, investors in House, which is for, you know, interior decor. The primary customer for that is actually women, as well as Dia & Co., which is a styling service for plus-size women. So before I got there, there was already a clear recognition that women are very important. I would say women are almost the most important consumer because we control 80% of household purchasing power, right? Like if you think about the mom... controlling parenting decisions, a lot of healthcare decisions, the household spend, like it's a very important consumer. And I knew Sequoia already understood that by the time I got there. So I do champion more of that stuff, maybe the things they don't personally experience as much, but that was already there. I think that some study came out, someone did an analysis and showed that Sequoia's backed more women than almost any other firm. So,
and so what's it like though, being on the other side of the table? Because you talked a little bit about the challenges pitching, you know, these largely male partnerships, but has it ever been difficult, like when you're in your partner meetings mm-hmm. and discussing potential investments?
Well, I think at the end of the day, we're trying to arrive at the right investment decision. And so it's like a no holds barred sort of like, what is the right answer? And it's really about getting to, you know, what are the key points of the investment thesis and what are the key risks? And so we walk into that room and we talk about investment, and it's not personal, right? It's just like, are we making the right decision for Sequoia, for the founder, and for the LPs, right? And our LPs are actually mostly endowments and charitable organizations like the Ford Foundation or Stanford. And, you know, we actually think about it that way. I've definitely heard Ruloff come in and say, hey, today this company, you know, lost this much market cap, and then he'll count 20 Stanford scholarships. Like we actually think that way. So it's an important decision to get right. So we go in and it's like, we're all talking and it can get very passionate. but we walk out of that room knowing it wasn't personal, right? We're a team at the end of the day, and we actually take the time to get to know each other. And so you just know it's not personal, but it is all about the decision. Yeah.
And now that you've seen the other side of things, do you have any advice that you give to female founders now that you wish you had known when you were pitching VCs?
Yes, so much. Now that I see both sides, I see all the mistakes I made. I see sort of how the differences between how women pitch and how men pitch. And I've actually, that was part of the inspiration for starting Female Founder Office Hours, which is sort of one-on-one mentoring sessions to try to help female founders just accelerate their success no matter any way possible. We started with fundraising. So we started that program, and I have a whole set of talks about this in a slide deck I'm happy to share. But some of the differences I see are, I think women often rely on empathy, like I said, to try to pitch their product versus relying on just different forms, right? So that's one thing. Don't rely on empathy. Explain the problem in very crisp detail. Don't jump to the solution. Explain the problem first and the size of the problem and why it's going to be a big business opportunity. The other thing I sometimes see is lack of sort of selling the big dream, right? Instead of being worried about where I am today, you know, can I survive the next year? When you're fundraising, that's the moment to pitch. This is where I'm going to be in 10 years. If I have everything go my way, this is how big and amazing my company could be. And I don't always see that. And then the last thing is the financial slide. So a lot of women will walk in and present their five-year P&L and say, even with the most conservative assumptions, here is where I'll get to, which is still a good business. Then I see a lot of men walk in and they say, here are my projections, and it's like a crazy plan. And they didn't say these are the most aggressive assumptions that I could possibly make, and they're probably wrong. But they don't qualify. They just show that versus trying to show the sort of base case, which is what a lot of women do. And this is a this is a VC pitch, right? So you have to understand that venture capitalists are not about minimizing risk. They're about maximizing like the upside potential, right? So instead of talking about the downside potential, talk about the upside potential. So just getting people, and you don't have to do anything you're not comfortable with, right? You can always show, here's the base case plan and here's the upside potential. But showing the upside is really, really, really important. And that's one of the mistakes that I see.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
And so about a year ago, the New York Times ran a front page story about sexual harassment in the venture industry. Yeah. And, you know, I'm just wondering, what was it like for you to see some of those stories come out as a female partner at one of the biggest firms?
Yeah, I mean, that was a pretty incredible set of great journalism and reporting, but very, like, really shone a light on all the bad behavior in tech and in venture. And I remember when I joined before all that happened, and I thought, okay, I want to change the ratio. I will just fight by myself and try to prove that women can be good VCs, and I'll try to back women and show that they can be successful founders of massive companies. Like, I will just fight the good fight. But after all that happened, we started to organize. So a venture capitalist named Aileen Lee, who was the first female partner. Yeah, I'm going to tell her people are clapping for her. She's so awesome. But she's one of the first female, she was, I think, the first female partner at Kleiner Perkins. And then she left and started her own firm. So one of the most successful female-founded VC firms. So she sent out a note to a bunch of women in VC and said, hey, it feels like the winds are changing and we have a window of opportunity to do something about it. So, you know, she sent it out. I responded immediately. I was like, let me know how I can help. I'll do anything. I'll help you organize. I'll be your logistics slave, whatever. And so we all ended up getting together for this first dinner. And because we're women, you know, we were very organized and we walked out of that with a plan, like a very clear plan that has actually not changed over the last year. It's basically, we care about two things: proving that women can be successful investors and proving that women can be successful founders. How do we make those outcomes happen and how do we accelerate that? And so we just started to meet on a monthly cadence and review those goals. And we had captains. After that first meeting, we had captains for these teams and working groups. And we just started reporting. And we kept each other accountable and kept launching these initiatives. So the first one was Female Founder Office Hours, which I mentioned is a one-on-one mentoring program for female founders. That got great reception from the industry. So we're like, maybe we're onto something. Then we launched another one. It's called Founders for Change. You may have seen it on Instagram. It's the it's the founders holding up signs that say, I'm a founder for change. And it's a commitment to the following statement. It says, you know, I'm committed to diversity and inclusion. I'm committed to improving diversity and inclusion on my team, my board, and when I have the choice of investment partners, the diversity of their firms will be an important priority. So it's not, I will only go to a firm, you know, take money from firms that are diverse, but I actually care about this. And we had 800 founders sign up for that, and not just women, right? The founder of Airbnb, of Dropbox, all these prominent men and women. And I think for a lot of firms, a light bulb went off. Oh, this is my customer. The founders are the ones who build the businesses, who drive the value. We might miss out because this generation, especially of younger founders, grew up with diversity. They actually care about it. So that's, you know, over the course of the last year, I think we've seen a lot of announcements saying first new female partner at firm. So I definitely feel like the winds are changing. So that kept going on. And then eventually all of this turned into a nonprofit called AllRaise. If you go to allraise.org, you can find out more about the group. But it's a collective of female VCs and female women, female VCs and female founders working together to improve diversity in the tech ecosystem. Yeah.
And so I know it's a group of female VCs, but why did you decide to focus on issues for both female founders and venture capitalists through the same organization?
Well, we felt like, you know, the women who were getting harassed, most of them were founders. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I definitely felt like that was definitely my passion point of, you know, thinking about all the female founders who struggled to raise money or had a harder time. And both of those are equally important. There's kind of and founders are also, I think, a feeder into the VC ecosystem. So everything's related, right? How many women are there maybe in computer science? And then who come, you know, how many women are there in the tech ecosystem overall? How many women are execs? How many become founders? How many become VCs? So I think it's all interrelated, and just seeing those successful examples makes a huge difference.
And since you've been having these female founder office hours, what are some of the outcomes that you've seen?
Yeah. So we started with a pool of maybe 15 mentors, female VCs from different firms. That pool has now expanded to 150 people, including many, many female founders, ranging from all stages. We've got Katrina Lake at Stitch Fix and Adita Tarko at Houzz, who are very far along, to founders who've raised $2 million, right? And the goal of that is to pair people with pair mentors with mentees. And it's not an ongoing forever relationship. It's a you get 45 minutes, a one-on-one to ask whatever you want, safe space, don't worry about being judged. The only goal is to help you. And we're trying to create a chain of pay it forward mentoring from every generation of female founder to the next. So on top of that, we also try to hack the warm intro to help female founders who don't maybe have that network get introduced to the right investors. So if you apply, you meet a mentor and you're raising money, then your mentor can recommend you and you can get introduced to a pretty large group of investors, actually. So to date, we've done, I think, about 350 one-on-ones. We just added the huge group of mentors like last month or 2 months ago. We'll probably do at least 1,000 one-on-ones this year. We continue to hold events. We had one yesterday on how to do M&A. And then we're starting to actually see the investments happen. So I think we have 3 investments so far that have come directly from female founder office hours. And then, you know, I'm sure there'll be more to come, but it's early days.
And what about Founders for Change? Can you tell us a little bit about who some of the founders are who have participated in that?
Sure. So I mentioned the founders of Airbnb, the founders of Dropbox, Nextdoor, Lyft, Instagram, Rent the Runway, just a lot, Warby Parker, like a ton, just a ton of founders have come forward and said, this actually matters to me. Airtable. If you go to foundersforchange.org, it's just like this beautiful gallery of all their pictures with the signs. So yeah, and it's been exciting to see 800 founders sign up.
And how did the VC firms who don't yet have a female partner react to that movement?
I think some of them started probably to panic and worry, right? You know, hey, this actually matters more than I thought. And at the end of the day, the quality of my firm and the returns depends basically on getting amazing founders to agree to work with us. And it's a very competitive industry. Like the best founders have multiple term sheets, right? So you don't want any disadvantage. So I think we've seen an acceleration of, and it's not entirely due to Founders for Change. I think this has been a trend that's moving in this direction for a long time. You know, there's been a lot of announcements lately of the first female partner. So I think it's been very positive.
And so you mentioned that this has kind of been a trend for a long time. And for a few years, we saw a lot of firms hiring more women, but at more junior levels. Is AllRaise doing anything to help those women move up within the firms?
Yes. So one of the working groups is about creating a community for the women in VC. So we put together our first group event was maybe 100 people got together, all different levels of women in VC, and the most senior women like did sort of these insidery panels sharing like, you know, here's the path to move up in a firm. Here's how I did it. We talked about work-life balance. We talked about how to be a good investor. And so we're continuing to do those types of community events. And I think we're trying to organize actually a conference later this year.
And so you came into VC from an operator role. So, I mean, what advice do you give other women who are trying to break into the VC industry? Do you think it's better to move up the ranks through a firm or kind of take the route that you did and start a company and then try VC after?
There's so many paths. Like, there's no one standard path. If you have, I wouldn't found a company in order to get into VC. You should found a company because you want to found a company because it's really hard. you know, I think you should just think about whether you'll like the job, right? And whether you'll be good at it. And there are sort of four different areas to think about. The first is sourcing, right? How are you going to meet founders and get access to the interesting companies that are being started? What's your proprietary way of doing that? What's the network that you have or want to build? So that's something to think about. The second is picking. So that I think most people walk into venture not actually knowing very much about that, but being able to pick of all the things you look at, which ones are going to turn into interesting companies. What you can start to do is you can start to keep a list as you come across things. And maybe if you're angel investing or you're just meeting founders, which are the ones you think are going to be good and sort of just track how you think they'll do. But it's really hard to know until you get there. And yet actually you need folks to help teach you. So I would always go to a firm where there's a culture of apprenticeship. Then after picking, it's winning, right? Because like I said, it's very competitive for the best founders. So how are you going to convince them that you're the one that they should work with? What's your special superpower or skill that you bring that you can help the founders with? The last thing is company building, which is the long part and takes the most time, right? You've gotten the investment, you signed the term sheet. Now there's, 5 to 10 years worth of being married to this founder, not being able to get a divorce, by the way. It's one of those decisions you can't roll back. And working with them to help them, to partner with them deeply to like figure out how to build that company and get it to success. So think about what your skill there might be. So that's how I would think about it. I wouldn't think about what's the right way to get in, but just how do I create that value for founders and what's my unique story there? And the other thing is if you are looking to get into venture, another working group inside of AllRaise is the diverse candidate database. So if you go to our website, you can actually sign up and just be on this mailing list and tell us a little bit about yourself and when roles open. Because VC hiring can be a little bit secretive, but when those roles open and we're encouraging firms to send their roles there, that gets sent out to the mailing list and you can figure out if you want to apply or not.
And so we're going to turn it over to question and answers in just a few minutes. So please get those questions ready. Wanted to ask you, we've seen, like you mentioned, a lot of firms make an announcement that, hey, we've hired our first female partner. And I've been writing a lot of news stories about that in the last year. But I wanted to ask you, what do you think has to happen for firms to hire not just their first female partner, but their second and third female partner?
I think the pipeline of talent is there. It's. I think some of it is women raising their hands and saying like, I want to do it, right? Because like I said, venture hiring right now is very secretive. So getting the roles out there in the open and then more and more women raising their hand and saying like, I am qualified to do this and here is why. Here are the answers to those four things that I mentioned and I'm gonna be amazing. So, yeah.
Got it. Okay, and now we'll turn it over to you for your questions.
Thank you so much for your comments and for a great moderation. So for context, I work at a wealth management firm, so a step away from the venture capitalist community. But how do you bridge the need for using finance to convince people with all of the awful things that come along with a purely financial lens when looking at diversity?
Do you mean quotas or do you mean the studies that show that diversity leads to better financial performance?
I mean, when people approach diversity, not from a point of empathy, but from a point of this is a good financial decision, purely from that.
Yeah. No, you definitely need both, right? And I think that's especially the younger generation has grown up with understanding and having that empathy and realizing diversity is important. So that's part of it. But I think you also, the more reasons you have to do it, the better. But I definitely agree you can't just do it from a financial perspective. And speaking of metrics, there's this one metric that I've always wished could be measured, which is sort of a person's distance traveled, right? Like if someone, I heard this from Frida Kapoor Klein at Kapoor Capital, but I think we look at people's resumes and we think about, oh, did you go to Harvard? Did you go to Stanford? And that's like a check. And that's sort of an absolute value or checkbox. But, if someone was already very privileged and grew up in Palo Alto and then went to Stanford versus someone who grew up in a different country, was an undocumented immigrant, moved here, and then went to a worse school, right? Like, it's not about the absolute measure. It's about how far did you travel? What is that distance traveled? Like, I wish I could get that metric on every resume, because I think that is a better predictor than whether or not you went to like a top Ivy institution. So to me, that's, hey, I stole that from Freedom. You know, I think I wish there was some way to quantify that.
Thank you so much. As someone breaking into human-centered design, your whole journey with Polyvore and looking at what you liked and what you didn't like and making that list because you were so passionate about the product, that was pretty inspiring to me. And I was wondering what your top sort of tips were regarding product critiques.
Oh, you know, I think you always start from the user, right? Like a deep, deep understanding of who is the user. What are their pain points, their motivations, and how do you use your product to almost like transform them, help them feel better a lot of times in consumer, do something better, accomplish something, and move, like transform from one state to another. So that's part of what I think about for product. Yeah. And then in terms of writing lists and feedback, like I think that's a trick that not enough people employ. Like when you're applying for a job, if you do a little bit of extra work for the job that you really, really, I wasn't actually, when I did that, I wasn't trying to apply for a job, but it is like the best tactic. Like I have had people who applied for roles at Polyvore who went above and beyond and put together presentation. And those little things make a huge, huge difference. So it's worth the effort for the things you really want.
Hi, I'm Sally Thornton. I'm a founder for Change.
Yay. What's your company?
It's called Forche. It's talent on demand, but for the high-skilled worker.
Cool.
And what I loved was I want to see more women just run companies, whether it's venture or self or whatnot. And when you talked about the advice that worked for you, I'm curious what advice you got that you ignored that was really important. I get a lot of advice and filtering like which advice to hear that was your rubric and which advice you were either happy you didn't listen to or you wish you hadn't listened to.
Yeah. So there's a class of advice that I think women get sometimes, which is the one I hear is don't bake cookies at work. Like don't bring cookies to work, right? Have you guys heard that?
No.
Yeah, like don't do feminine things, right? That are girly and like in the kitchen because women shouldn't just be in the kitchen. I always thought that was... There's nothing wrong with being in the kitchen, right? And producing the food for the household. You know, a lot of people love cookies. And, you know, I had a very, very successful engineering manager at Polyvore named Cindy Chu. And she baked cookies for the team every single Monday. And I cannot tell you how excited people were about that every Monday, right? And it was like part of our culture and our tradition. And people didn't interpret that as like, oh, you're like a cook. Like they interpreted that as you care enough about your team that you're willing to go the extra mile to do this thing that delights everyone in the office, right? And I think trying to tell people that feminine things are bad or act like a man or don't do, like be gender neutral, like at the end of the day, you have to figure out what your strengths are. And you have to lean into those and you have to be amazing at a few things that are very you. You just have to be yourself. There's no other way around it. And so I don't like advice that tells you not to do certain things. Like you have to find your own style. There's no one prototype of what a leader looks like, of what a good manager looks like, of what a good designer looks like. You really have to find your own way. So those are that's the kind of advice that I don't particularly love.
Hi, thanks for taking the time to come out today. My question is around San Francisco can be a little bit of a bubble. Like it's not a really good indication of the startup or VC community elsewhere in the globe.
Yeah.
But you're also a global citizen and a lot of people are increasingly that. So can you talk a little bit to what the rest of the world looks like with regards to female founders and female VC environments?
Yeah, so I grew up in Hong Kong and I would say that China is probably ahead in terms of empowering women, which is weird, maybe odd because it's a sort of old Confucian culture and it's also got its own set of stereotypes. But possibly because of the Cultural Revolution, where everyone just got flattened out at the same sort of starting point, I don't know if that's why, but there are many more female CEOs in China. So I would say China is a little bit ahead in terms of women leading companies. I mean, it's all over the place across the world. But I would say China is one of the probably the leaders in that space.
Hi, thank you for the talk. I'm interested in becoming a managing partner, and I'd like to understand more about the salary compensation. It's difficult to get information on it and whether or not investing is required, and if you're a beginner salary versus an advanced.
Yeah, so that varies so much firm to firm. I honestly have a data point of one, so I don't really have like a lot of guidance for you. You know, I think the way VCs are compensated is there's a salary that comes from the management fee. So, you know, VCs have a fund that comes from their LPs, the limited partners, put in a bunch of capital. So for Sequoia, that's Stanford University, MIT, Ford Foundation, all that money. Usually there's a percentage of that that goes into management fees, which is salaries for everyone at the firm, not just the investing partners, but everyone, finance, people ops, everyone. And then there's carry. So when the fund does well, you take a percentage of the returns, right? Part of that. So that's generally the general structure. But how carry is allocated, whether some of that gets pulled aside for top performers, what the scales are, it just varies so much from firm to firm that I genuinely don't have a lot of great advice to give you. But that's sort of how it works at a high level.
Hi, thanks so much for the talk. My question is around myself trying to become a female founder, working on a project myself. How do you go about finding other female co-founders? So all of the technical roles, specifically engineering, it feels like there are so many men that are raising their hands to become co-founders and ideas, but there are no real women who feel that they are capable enough or have the skills to become a co-founder of someone just with an idea. Are there any specific platforms or events or things that you've found where women can also find co-founders and technical co-founders and things like that?
So there is another group called Women in Product, and maybe they're not, some of them are very technical, some of them are not, but I think they do a great job with their conferences, and there's a lot of women there who, as PMs, like I think product managers are, good product managers are a little bit like mini CEOs, so a lot of them have the combination of business and acumen and technical skills to potentially become founders. So that is, I think, one place that I would look. And then I would just think back on all the female engineers you've worked with. And even if they are not thinking about starting a company, go and bug them and convince them, right? That's what I would do.
Hi, Jess. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Maya. I'm currently a product design intern at Facebook and an incoming junior at Cornell. And I'm kind of, you know, finally having this decision of what to do, just not even for a next internship, but, you know, right after college. And I wanted to know, so you found out about Polyvore when you were at Google and you fell in love with the product. And I wanted to know if you had found out about Polyvore before you had graduated, would you still have gone to Google to get the training, or would you have gone to Polyvore because you were so passionate about the mission?
I think I would fall back on that same framework of like, which of these is a once in a lifetime opportunity, or more likely once in a lifetime, versus which one will be around for a long time. So I think I probably would have gone to Polyvore if I'd found it right out of college. I may not have known that at the time, and I would have struggled with the exact same thing. But looking back, I would probably try to go. I would go for the Polyvore.
Hi, Jess. Thank you for your time. And this is a little bit interesting question that just comes after the Facebook and Google discussions. There are some problems that are created by big tech companies these days. Those makes a great investment for VCs. But as a person working in tech, we, like me and my peers, we've gone through a lot of soul searching. And I'm wondering if this is a topic that when you make your investment decisions or when you coach your companies, that would ever come up in terms of like, how do we make product that with more ethics?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I don't think the answer has been figured out broadly across the tech ecosystem. I think this is something that many tech companies are struggling with. We were talking about this earlier. For me personally, I feel, and I think this is actually starting to become more of the norm in corporations. I think CEOs do have an obligation to think about how their product impacts the world beyond a business perspective, but also on a social impact level, to really think about it. So I prefer working with founders who care about those things, who have a clear mission in their mind for why their company exists. Again, that's why I love the Wonolo founders so much, because they genuinely care about solving underemployment. from a true and genuine place. But you're starting to see more of this, like prominent CEOs like starting to write about this, say, hey, we have a duty, we need to fix things. And a lot of it, some of it's coming out of the financial, I think, was it the Blackstone? I can't remember, but someone, maybe not you wouldn't have expected, but more and more of that is starting to happen. I think it, I personally think it's very important.
Hi, I'm Natalie. I'm also from Hong Kong, so it's great seeing someone else from Hong Kong here. I actually have a question more on like how your style may have evolved as a VC. So like, you know, initially maybe it was more like you maybe you wanted more control of like how to run the company. Like, I'm just curious overall like what you learned.
Oh, my style, not my style.
Oh, no. Yeah. Your investment style.
Yeah. Yeah, how has my style changed? So, honestly, I really think you have to figure out over the course of your career what you're really amazing and special at and lean into that more and more. So, you know, I found my style has always been, I'm a little quirky, a little awkward sometimes, but very transparent. So, you know, people don't think that my team always felt like, okay, you can be a little weird and you don't always know what you're doing, but you are always honest with us, right? You tell us when there is a problem, you rally us to fix it together, and you build community and sort of this feeling that we're all in it together. And that was always one of my strengths through all the ups and downs, especially the downs. You know, I think that's when people actually want the truth the most. And so that sort of style of trying to be authentic and trying to be real has carried through everything. It's just, it's like hard to do anything else. And on top of that, the community building, right? So that's always been important to me. And so whether it was community building at Polyvore with the product and the users who loved fashion, or with the female founder community, right? Like, I spent a lot of time on that because it's really important to me. And I think community has power, right? The power of the network, even if it's a small network. Like, I always think about this in tech, like if we're building a network, we may not have the most nodes in the network, but we can have the strongest bonds, right? And that's really, really powerful too. So I always think about that. And that has been pretty consistent.
Hi, my name is Sasha Williams. I'm a 17-year-old rising senior at Carondelet. And so I was wondering, as a teenage entrepreneur, what is like the advice that you truly give, especially to your younger generation? And also, what is your ultimate goal in like creating that like high potential stake and as a VC communicating to like new founders and new entrepreneurs, mainly female?
Mm. What would I tell a 17-year-old entrepreneur? You know, I think this applies whether you're 17 or 27 or 37. Creating a company and building something out of nothing and rallying people to come work out with you when they could get paid more elsewhere or work on something that's a little bit more certain, it's just really hard, right? And things go wrong all the time. And you're so attached to your idea and to your company that sometimes every little bump feels like it's the end of the world. And you put so much stress and heartache into it. But the thing to realize is that that bumpiness is par for the course. Every startup, every founder, every entrepreneur goes through that struggle, but we don't talk about it as much usually. Like, you read TechCrunch and all these great announcements, you're like, wow, everyone else is crushing it except me. So I think I would go back and tell any founder, that is not true. No one is crushing it. Even the companies that seem like they're doing well, the founder is probably stressed out of their mind and worried about something, right? So the only way to get through that is, I think, to form those communities, right? Maybe my advice to you would be find the other 17-year-old founders, 18-year-old founders, 27-year-old founders, and build a community, right, to support you. Because you may find, oh my God, I have this huge problem, it's the end of the world. If you talk to enough founders, you'll probably find one who said, I had that problem 3 months ago and this is what I did. Or you'll be the one driving the solution. But the power of that network and that community like is life-saving for both your company and for your mental health. So that's the advice that I'd give.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hello, my name is Olga Sergeyevich. I'm building a business development platform at City Ventures. You spoke about the importance of getting women into jobs in VC and tech, and I think another important part of it is boards of directors.
Agreed.
So are there certain organizations in Silicon Valley in tech that you would recommend for women both to get mentorship and get access to opportunities to find out about these positions,
yeah,
but also for VCs to get pipeline for board positions for their portfolio companies?
I would recommend the Board List. That's an organization that's been around for a while that tries to help place women into board roles. I agree that's incredibly important, but that's probably the organization that's doing this most at scale.
Hi, Jess. Thank you so much. Really interesting. I'm the CEO of a company developing imaging software for food distribution. So it's a really industrial product. And I was wondering if you have any advice or thoughts on women or female CEOs who are developing quite industrial solutions for very male-dominated audiences, which also aren't really, which are quite a niche in the investment community, like food or manufacturing, for example.
Mm-hmm. So a founder who I really love that inspires me is Tracy Young at PlanGrid. So her company, PlanGrid, develops construction, works for, you know, the customers are the construction industry, which is also very male dominated, and construction workers who are using the product as well. But she just has this way about her where she's like, look, I know a lot about this industry. I worked in it. I am the expert, right? So she really relies on that deep empathy and understanding for the customer of the customer, and she just builds the best product possible based on that. So I think that is maybe the best advice I can offer. Go watch everything Tracy has ever done. She's amazing. And just like, don't feel shy about like owning it, that you know the customer better than anyone, and even though you don't look like anyone in the industry.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all for those great questions. So now it's kind of an Inforum tradition to ask one more. So what is your 60-second idea to change the world, Jess?
Oh, that's a lot of pressure. You know, I talked a lot about empathy and how important that is. And I think the world could use a little bit more empathy right now. So if I had unlimited money for this idea, which I'm just going to assume that I do, I think I would make a study abroad program for every U.S. citizen, right? If everyone could travel and maybe go to, you know, different parts of the world, like go to Scandinavia and see what it's like, go to Thailand and see what it's like, go to a place where there's different, you know, socioeconomic status is completely different. If you could just see what it was like, and sure, things would be very, very different. But if you stayed there long enough, I'm sure you would make friends and realize that no matter what, humans are very, very similar and that they care about love and family and just taking care of the people they love, right? And if you could see that, then maybe you'd be able to see past some of the other differences. So that would be my study abroad for everyone would probably be my my idea to change the world.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.